morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday, May 30th, was the original Memorial Day, declared a national holiday 150 years ago in 1868. Memorial Day was first established as a special day of national mourning for the dead of the Civil War, which had ended 3 years earlier. Everyone killed on either side of that war, or caught in between, was an American, including slaves. Many more wars since have expanded the nation's body count. If we are to honor Memorial Day, we should do it for real. The same with Labor Day, or abolish both, in recognition they have been trivialized to little more than facades for commercially sponsored parties, both simply bookends for the silly season. And Memorial Day should return to a single day, May 30th, and be regarded in its original intent, commemoration of the nation's war dead, and to question the always questionable purposes for their deaths. Yesterday was also the 70th anniversary of the Memorial Day flood of Vanport, Oregon, May 30th, 1948. I dedicate today's program to the victims of Vanport, most of whom were poor white and black Americans, many of them World War II veterans, and to the previously unreported 4,645 dead victims of Hurricane Maria, all of them American citizens of Puerto Rico, who were obviously left to die by a criminally negligent and blatantly racist American government. I start the program with something I wrote, and actually I wrote it back in 1974 for a magazine, Metropolis, at Portland State University. Vanport, the town nobody wanted. One of the world's worst examples of city planning was Vanport, Oregon, the city where Delta Park in Portland is now. When it was dramatically submerged like a latter-day Atlantis on Memorial Day in 1948, Vanport had a population of almost 20,000 persons, all of whom were made homeless by the rampaging Columbia and Willamette Rivers in less than an hour and a half. A faulty dike system was the cause of Vanport's death. The water poured through a break in an old railroad embankment, and for weeks, Vanport was at the bottom of a lake. The reason Vanport died is of vital importance to contemporary land use planning. What was Vanport? It was a war baby, born of necessity for housing some 40,000 workers for Henry J. Kaiser's shipyards in Portland and Vancouver. It was the second largest city in Oregon during World War II, and was once described by former Portland Mayor Earl Riley as the largest housing project in the nation. Vanport was built in 1942 on marshy lowlands along the Columbia River, less than 2 miles from where the Columbia converges with the Willamette. Touted as the miracle city on the Columbia that Kaiser built, Vanport was never more than a huge collection of, quote, cracker box houses strung together fast and cheap, unquote, according to one of its residents. But from its conception, Vanport was more than just a war baby. It was a bastard child. It had no mayor or city council, but was instead administered by the Portland Housing Authority. It had no local industry except for gas stations and grocery stores. It had a population of blue-collar workers, at least one-fourth of whom were blacks, recruited by Kaiser from southern states. After the war, Portland used Vanport as the dumping ground for its human waste, a former resident said. By the time the flood wiped us out, it was almost all low-cost housing for the poor. The City of Roses made no pretense of hiding its fears that Vanport was a slum in making, a potential cesspool of crime, a debaser of real estate values, and a prospective leech on the tax roll, Walter Matula wrote in the Oregon Journal a year after the flood. As the largest housing project in the nation, Vanport could become the biggest municipal headache of its time, Mayor Riley said in October 1945. Julia Rutila, who was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division for her investigative reporting of the flood, said that after the war, the power structures in Portland and Vancouver, Washington, wanted all the blacks to go back where they came from. Many of them did, she said, but at least one-fourth of Vanport's population at the time of the flood was black. The other largest single group was veterans who came to Vanport after the war and couldn't find jobs. Because of that situation, one-fourth of the city was on welfare. I think because the majority of Vanport's population was poor, Ms. Rutila continued, black and white, whether on welfare or working at low-paying jobs, the housing authority just didn't care to meet its responsibilities to the people. Never has a city grown so big so fast, lived so short a life, and died so suddenly with so little loss of life, Everett Richards wrote about Vanport in the Oregonian on the 20th anniversary of the Memorial Day flood. At least a score of Vanport's residents died in the flood. Thousands lost everything they owned. It would seem that the planners who would build a city in a swamp between two rivers would deem flood control as a first priority. All we had in Vanport was a makeshift leaky dike system and no little Dutch boy to plug it with his finger, a survivor said, 25 years after the disaster. The dike that broke had been an old railroad embankment constructed of sand and soft earth that was never intended to resist the powerful lateral hydraulic pressure of a flood or protect a town, an editorial in the Portland Sun said 3 days after the dike burst. The Oregon media agonized over the Vanport disaster, but all it could do was raise questions for which there were obvious answers, and just as obvious, a desire to avoid them. Former Oregonian reporter Bob Clark, whose Vanport home was destroyed by the flood, posed one of the questions a month later. We have learned that the Columbia long had regarded those murky bottoms as her own property, he wrote. We have been told that she swept through from time to time when the Snake, Willamette, or other tributaries dumped too much water into her main channel. Did the men who laid out Vanport know that? Clark asked. Julia Rutila says they did. She said several members of the Army Corps of Engineers had warned the housing authority before Vanport was built that the area was one of calculated risk. But I don't think they really cared, she said. Portland didn't want the blacks. Neither did Vancouver. That was one of the main reasons Vanport was built, and I seriously believe a reason the housing authority chose to go ahead and build the city in that area of calculated risk. Hours before the floodwater swept through the Smith Lake Dike, Army engineers and housing authority officials inspected the dike and reported in good shape, quote unquote. By that time, the housing authority had moved its records out of Vanport, and the supermarkets moved out their safes, Ms. Rutila said. All they left were the people. Residents had become increasingly worried when the rivers began rising before the fateful Memorial Day. Unseasonal runoff of late snow and several days of heavy rains had swollen the Columbia and Willamette rivers to levels not recorded since the 1894 flood of Portland. To counter growing demands for evacuation of Vanport from its residents, the housing authority responded with a handbill that was delivered from door to door, proclaiming, "The dikes are safe at present. You will be warned if necessary. You will have time to leave. Don't get excited." The executive board of the Vanport Tenants League filed suit against the housing authority a month after the flood. The case, which never reached the courts, demanded the housing authority be held legally responsible for not having evacuated the people of Vanport prior to the flood, not having provided an adequate warning system, and for having issued reassuring statements denying any immediate danger. When people talk or write about Vanport, they only talk about the flood, a survivor said. They don't deal with the fact that thousands of us were homeless or were forced to live in trailers or in barracks on Swan Island for months afterward. The housing authority did nothing to find replacement housing. We had to find it for ourselves, which was almost impossible because of housing shortages and the fact most of us were financially wiped out by the flood. Ms. Rutila, a reporter for the Longshoreman Dispatcher since 1946, was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division because she wrote that the victims were, quote, left entirely to their own devices with no aid from public agencies, unquote. The Welfare Division had declared the flood was a natural disaster and that the refugees were not entitled to relief, she said. The Red Cross took the same position. Churches and schools threw open their doors, and several people took some of the victims into their homes, but there were thousands. Ms. Rutila said she and an Associated Press reporter went to the director of the Housing Authority after the flood and suggested that vacant hotel and motel rooms in Portland be used to temporarily house the Vanport refugees. He told us he couldn't do it because the rooms were reserved for Rose Festival visitors, she said. The Corps of Engineers says there will never be another flood like the Memorial Day flood of 1948. They say the 14 major dams on the Columbia River and its major tributaries will resist another flood of Vanport proportion. As for Vanport's graveyard, it was designated for recreational land use because no one wanted to live there anymore. The destruction of the Vanport houses was long overdue, Dr. Richard M. Steiner, who was pastor of Portland's First Unitarian Church at the time of the flood, told his congregation and the Oregon Journal a month afterward. The tragedy lies in the destruction of lives and personal property, he said. A different housing authority, more concerned for the people and less concerned for real estate values, would have long since created permanent housing for low-income groups in our city. The city of Portland still not. Has met that. The city of Portland, pardon me, still has not met that responsibility 70 years later. And now, to proceed along the same avenue, in a sense, of land use, something I wrote also, this time 30 years ago in 1988 for my old newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. I called it Summer Gold Rush. And I believe it still holds. The silly season is in full avarice. Cash registers from coast to coast and amusement parks in between are playing America's song. Our Oregon and Washington beach towns are emporiums of prosperity, their streets and sands swarming with an annual infestation of sun and fun hungry protoplasm. Everybody wants a cut of a tourist buck. Tourism attempts to fill the void left by depleted natural resources, whose exploitation built and sustained the local coastal culture until the forests were cut down and the great fish runs decimated by the impetuous greed of white settlers and their descendants. A magnificent land that had thrived for millennia was ravaged in a century. Now, sultans of fun replace loggers and fisher people. They build shopping malls, condominiums, bigger and glitzier motels, restaurants, and bars that remove the remaining trees and block ocean views. Cannon Beach, which in an earlier era resisted opportunities to be a second Carmel, has acquiesced and booms like a gold strike town. Seaside mixed its sand with water and remade its graceful downtown into a cement mall. Astoria hustles its failed history and Carpenter Gothic houses to draw tourists from the beach towns. Complaints about tourism are usually whines about discourtesies, inconveniences, and crowds of noisy, fussy, impatient strangers. But sometimes criticisms are registered about the sort of environment that is being imposed upon a previously neglected string of coastal towns and the ambivalence of residents between tourist revenues and environmental quality. The current practices of coastal entrepreneurs are a local symptom of a national malady, that money is all that counts and anything in the way of making a buck deserves to be deep-sixed. Tourism has a habit of destroying what it seeks, and amidst the commercial glitter and singing cash registers, the real gold is slipping out of our hands. Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach, and in 1980 wrote an article for the Times Eagle, A Short History of Seaside, perceived clearly and early the changes tourism has wrought. And this is from Connie. Somewhere behind the pavement, the aluminum-framed, junk-filled windows, the pinball machines and snow cone litter, lurks the ghost of a pretty little beach town, a town that welcomed progress as a friend, resisted not at all, and in the short span of a man's lifetime, died under its feet with little more than a whimper. Seaside, whatever it is today, is not a pretty little town, either in physical appearance or character. The Oregon coast wears on its shores a string of such pretty little towns, Cannon Beach, Manzanita, Nehalem, all today facing the same forces and models of thinking which have transformed so many of Oregon's coastal gems into a string of tasteless clunkers. Like Godzilla in a greenhouse, the tourist industry is a powerful force plowing through the small town's natural environment, leaving in its wake a trail of highway architecture, parking lots, condominiums, mobile home courts, souvenir junk outlets, and the threat of legalized gambling. And the pretty little town loses more than just its physical beauty to the impersonal wasteland of a commercially controlled tourist trap. It loses its small-town energy and character, which are the truest sources of its beauty and grace, and which loss no cosmetic compromise by developers can remedy or replace. And that was Connie Rose Anderson, and that was Summer Gold Rush, which I wrote 30 years ago. And I think it is astute for today. And now, again, this almost seems to be a solo program of things I have written. Again, something I have written. Do dead soldiers have souls? On this day after the real Memorial Day, I quote Barbara Bush on the advent of the Iraq War on March 18, 2003. Why should we hear about body bags and deaths? It's not relevant. So why should I waste my beautiful mind on something like that? The only purpose for armies is the destruction of other human beings. Soldiering is big business, the first order of every empire, as it has been since ancient times. But soldiers themselves are little more than expendable pawns, readily discarded. Without soldiers, there would be no wars, no Caesars, no Napoleons, no Hitlers, and perhaps no Putins or his ghastly Doppler banger, Donald Trump. Soldiers kill, rape, pillage, burn, and if they are unlucky, stupid, or badly led, they die. The most fierce and acquisitive sweep away the gentle and least avaricious. It was that way when our hairy ancestors thrust pointed sticks at each other. It is that way now when weapons of our industry are able to reduce continents to radioactive ash in minutes. Our mental evolution of the past 10,000 years has not eradicated the savagery or terror of our most primitive ancestors. We continue to regard other humans, and by extension, other cultures, nations, religions, and races as our blood enemies. We continue to think of war as our right to dominate or destroy whoever is weaker, different, or in the way. Paradoxically, humans never seem more unified, so able to collectively surmount tremendous obstacles as when we make war against each other. But war is never necessary, and there has never been a good war, only bad wars that compel a tribe, a city, a nation to defend itself against the ruthless ambitions of an eager enemy. The sudden renewed possibility of nuclear war in either one or both East Asia or the Middle East, cradles of human civilization, is a possibly genocidal symbol that humanity is threatening its future existence by never progressing past its earliest superstitions, which originated from the most elemental questions pertaining to life and purpose, but have been frozen in mutually savage dogmas like fossils in ice. Usually the tempest before a war is the most dangerous and intense period of global relations. The world is again at that point, a critical moment of history that will determine if mechanisms designed to prevent nuclear war will work as intended, despite the absurdly reckless pressures to fire the missiles. History is not important to avoid mistakes of the past, as George Santayana suggested, but a predicator of what we corrupt souls are likely to do to one another in the future, as David Hoppe once paraphrased Kurt Vonnegut. Most of the latter-day wannabe war makers are themselves war virgins, very protective of their combat chastity. They think of themselves as the best and brightest, but in truth are hardly more than schoolyard bullies, mean-spirited, avariciously corrupt, with little but callous contempt for anyone else. They equate disagreement with their war drums as tantamount to treason, and blitz the national consciousness with mendacious bromides to conceal their specious deceits that needlessly set up for slaughter overseas civilians and their own soldiers in seemingly forever wars fomented by lies and savage disregard of dissenting opinion. Soldiers have been lied to throughout history. They have always been coerced in one manner or another to commit and suffer humanity's most hideous acts, generally in the names of its most sanctified beliefs. That has not changed. Americans who are fighting, killing, and dying all over the world are as deceived as to underlying purposes as were their predecessors of wars immemorial. And the rewards for such guileless intrepidity are as always unequal and usually disproportionate to the fervid sacrifice for them. The grunts on the ground, sea, and air most likely cling to a tenacious faith, or at the very least hope their great personal risks are for the exalted principles that are claimed, that their leaders are literally keeping the faith with them. Yet every day, Americans and their combat cohorts face equal tenacity by hardcore resistances determined to oust invaders they regard as infidel imperialists, as pernicious as the earlier medieval European crusaders at the beginning of the last millennium. Public support for the soldiers acts contrarily as a relentless goad that pushes them into irreversible horror, at the same time cheering war cries crush any who would conscientiously or fearfully object. The soldiers feel compelled to carry out what they perceive to be the public mandate, and in the belief that any personal doubts would be met with harsh disapproval, they would most likely do their duty at whatever cost. Yet the soldiers we are exhorted to uncritically support can be readily turned against us to suppress public dissent and round up political activists. In especially this squalid age of Trump, such repressive use of military might could have potent support among indigenous neo-Nazis and corrupt political supremacists. The war parties in particular always strive to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent as sedition and disloyalty, even as they themselves practice treachery to constitutional governance. Our revolutionary ancestors anticipated critical moments of great tragedy and anxiety, such as now, and realized that unscrupulous persons or parties would seize the opportunity to grasp supreme power and dismantle the Constitution. Indeed, Trump, more a Caligula or Nero than a Hitler, seems to be in a frantic race to dismantle democracy and constitutional law, as well as start wars, foreign and domestic, before he is held accountable to the law and indicted for treason. And it might be plausible, poetic justice, if war veterans from all over the USA were to converse to converge on the White House in a countervailing protest of Trump's threats to make nuclear war. The belligerent manner in which Trump and his equally unsavory ego nemesis, Kim Jong-un, exchange nuclear taunts should make both liable for severe sanctions by the United Nations and at least criminal intent injunctions by the World Court. This is what the UN was meant for in the nuclear age, a community of nations constraining rogue nations, which North Korea is, and Trump's USA is swiftly becoming, from committing nuclear holocaust. In other words, there seems to be no planet B at present. Humanity should seek a possible alternative somewhere in the universe in the very near future, because a stew of nukes, gross overpopulation, and rapid catastrophic climate change do not mix except at the terminus point. And now I would like to read a quote by Dalton Trumbo to finish the program. If the dead mean nothing to us, except on Memorial Day weekend, when the National Freeway is clotted with surfers, swimmers, skiers, picnickers, campers, hunters, fishers, footballers, beer busters, what of our wounded? Does anyone know where they are, how they feel? How many arms, legs, ears, noses, mouths, faces, penises they've lost? How many are deaf and dumb or blind or all three? How many are single or double or triple or quadruple amputees? How many will hang on as decebriated vegetables, quietly breathing their lives away in small, dark, secret rooms? And that was Dalton Trumbo. And now, a poem by William Stafford, Oregon's eternal poet laureate emeritus, which he wrote in 1945. The End of the War. All violent, like the knife that drove, the pity begging life out through the eyes, and the wilt of the choked voice in little cries that bubbled and blinked out along the floor. All hungry like the outlaw stare that tore the north and reeled the rivers in along the spool that never would unwind them anymore or wander cool, but stretched them taut to all that's far away. All lost by dusty roads, all fled with love, all hit along with play. All hurt by what we lost, who conquered in the war, so violent, so lost, so far away. And this is Michael McCusker. Remember the three R's: resist, revolt, reform.